We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
O'clock.
Okay, hi everybody. Today's topic, as well as next week's, will be the Kohelet. If you have comments as I go on, or corrections, or any kind of anything whatsoever, so please feel free to type in or suggest something. I guess I should really sort of define my goals over 2 weeks. One is to talk about the two sort of the unity of the book. I want to try to accomplish by showing the unity of the book, and how while it's really written by one book, one author, there are different opinions. The author is presenting different opinions within his book. Next week I'll get into the different approaches and opinions as the author sort of presents ideas and theses and encounters them with an antithesis. But today I think it's important to focus on the unity of the book and to demonstrate its unity and, God willing, its holiness as well. And from there we can go on. So I have to say that my first experience with Kohelet was quite a few years ago. Heard it many times during services during Sukkot, during the Sukkot holiday, but never really studied the book in depth. And my only experience of Kohelet was from this book here. I'm going to hold it up to the camera, which is Jewish Literacy by Telushkin. And I was really kind of I don't remember. I may be recreating history. But I think that when I read it, if it didn't bother me at the time, it bothered me later when I actually began to study Kohelet in particular, and Tanakh, Bible in general, in a more scholarly way. And I sort of thought back to what Telushkin wrote about Kohelet, and I was really quite upset, and something I think I really have to deal with in a public forum. And I'm sure that Joseph Telushkin is a great scholar and knows quite a bit about Jewish history. I do not believe he's a Bible scholar, and there's some things that I really like to correct about what he said, because reading his book, I think, is problematic. So allow me to read a short passage from it. It says, Ecclesiastes, which is the name for Kohelet, is indeed one of the three books attributed by Jewish tradition to the 10th century BCE King Solomon. So that is not correct, but I'm going to get back to that issue in a little bit. Let me read on. The rabbis believed he wrote the exuberantly romantic Song of Songs, the Shir HaShirim, as a young man, the wise and reflective Proverbs in his Middle Ages, and the gloomy Ecclesiastes in his old age. Today, Telushkin writes, I'm continuing to read from Telushkin, today, few scholars accept the attribution of the book's authorship to Solomon. For one thing, Ecclesiastes uses words that were unknown in Solomon's time. For example, pardes, in chapter 2, verse 5. A Persian word meaning both grove and paradise first became known to the Jews probably no earlier than the 6th century BCE. Finding it included, so Telushkin writes, finding it, that is the word pardes, included in a work supposedly written 4 centuries earlier, i.e. by Shlomo, is as jarring as it would be to find the word Oldsmobile in a sonnet attributed to Shakespeare. So Telushkin writes, it's on page 105 of his Jewish Literacy. This is, what he writes, is completely wrong. Finding the word Oldsmobile in Shakespeare is what's called an anachronism. He says jarring, but the correct term is anachronism. Oldsmobiles did not exist in Shakespeare's time, and therefore if one found the word Oldsmobile in a Shakespeare sonnet, one would know that if that passage, if not the entire thing, the entire sonnet, was not written by Shakespeare. The word pardes, which does exist in Kohelet, is a Persian word which absolutely existed during King Shlomo's time. Again, an Oldsmobile did not exist during Shakespeare's time. The word pardes existed and was in use in Persia and probably India in some form, in Shlomo's time, that is 10th century BCE. The question is not whether the word pardes existed. It's whether Shlomo would have known such a word, or if he did know such a word, whether he would have used it in writing his own text. It's only an anachronism if it's something that didn't exist at the time. The word pardes existed at the time. Now, you could certainly argue that the word pardes might not be used by an author until the 6th century, some 4 centuries after Shlomo HaMelech, because it wasn't well known by its people. However, Shlomo HaMelech was a master of trade at that point, so the Torah Tanakh describes to us, that the whole world came to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was essentially the economic center, much like New York is probably the world's economic center today. It is absolutely possible, if not probable, that the word pardes, which is a Persian word, was brought to Shlomo by a trading person who described the beautiful paradises, pardesim, or groves that they saw in Persia and or India. So, but to say it's an anachronism is completely wrong. The second thing that Telushkin is wrong about is as follows. Our rabbis did not attribute the book of Kohelet to King Solomon at all. In fact, let me take you to a Gemara. I'm going to go to a screen right now. So what will flash on your screen is a Gemara, Bava Batra, from the Talmudian Babylonian tractates. I'm just going to click over right now, so just a second. And I have it in Microsoft Word, so I just have to find that. There we go. Okay. Now, on your screen should be showing up passages from Masechet Bava Batra, Perek Aleph, Chapter 1. On page 14 B side of the folio, or Yudalad Amud Bet, begins the section about who wrote the various books of Tanakh. I'm going to scroll down just a little bit, but we're not going to read the first section, which is who wrote the Torah, what did Moshe write. We're going to go to this section here on who wrote the books of, let me just read it instead of explaining it. Let's start a little bit earlier just so we have context. Yirmiyahu Katav, Jeremiah wrote, Sifro, his book, the Sefer Malachim, the keynotes. I'll just highlight that. So Jeremiah wrote those three things. And I want to point out that Jeremiah, therefore, let me continue on before taking a side tour. Chizkiyahu v'siyato, King Hezekiah, who lived and ruled in the year 720 approximately, about 726 to 701, which is 2.5 centuries after King Solomon, Katvu, he wrote Yishayahu, Mishle, Shir HaShirim, v'Kohelet. Which means our rabbis did not believe that Solomon wrote Kohelet, nor did they write Song of Songs, nor did he write Proverbs or Mishle, nor did Isaiah write the book of Isaiah. Chizkiyahu and his followers, and his school, Chizkiyahu of Siato, wrote these books. Now here it's very important to understand, therefore, what the rabbis are saying. And I'm going to come back to full screen, just a second. And this way I can see all, and you can see me while I explain it. Okay, I should be back now. What that means is, when it says katvu et ha-sefer, it obviously doesn't mean authored the book, because there's no question that in the books themselves it says Shlomo wrote these passages, or this is the Song of Song by Solomon. What the Gemara means by katvu is not so much authored, but edited. What that means is that Solomon had a great deal of wisdom that he wrote down, probably some of it was oral and some of it was written, and it was probably passed around from schools to schools, from places to places, in the form of manuscripts. Chizkiyahu, King Hezekiah, who lived 3 centuries later, in the year 726, he ruled from 726 to approximately the year 701, put together these books in the format that we know. So all of a sudden, we're not in the year 1000, But Chezkiyahu has the option as the editor to be able to say, well, let me put in the word pardes. Shlomo may have used a different word, like etzim, but I'll put in pardes to make it seem a little bit more modern. Moreover, it's very possible that when it says Chezkiyahu v'siyato, it may have... good question. Shalom in Toronto was asking the word edited or sidru. It would be sidru. I don't want to take you back, but if you look back in that Gemara, it specifically says that David HaMelech Katav Sifro Al Yedei 10 people. And what that means is Moshe, for instance, was credited for writing a Tehillim, one of the Tehillim. B'nai Korach are credited for writing a Tehillim. So when it says David Katvu, that actually does, it seems quite clear that it means edited. Now, the actual word for, another word for editing would be lechaber, which means to tie things together. So it's true, in modern Hebrew, lechtov does mean to write. But you have to sort of see it in the bigger light. When you say katvu, I'll give a better example. Esther wrote her own book, Katvat HaSefer. Although it's Anshei Knesset Agdola who are finally attributed, and back in that Gemara that I had on the screen, it says that Anshei Knesset Agdola wrote Esther. But wait a second, Esther wrote it. Yeah, but there's a famous Gemara about how she sent her Megillah to Anshei Knesset Agdola. They didn't like this and that. They sent it back to Esther. Esther did a rewrite. She sent it back to Anshei Knesset Agdola, and they have final... I don't want to say authorship. That is, the Hebrew word used in the Gemara is katvu. But it's quite clear that really what Anshei Knesset Agdola did to Esther's book was modify it, edit it, and put the final stamps onto the text. That demonstrates that when it says lichtov or katvu in the book, in Baba Batra, that it might be authorship, but it might also equally be editorial. I'll give you another example. Yirmiyahu katav et Sefer Malachim. But he didn't write the whole Sefer Malachim. The beginning part was clearly written by some of Shlomo's people. And there's prophecy from Achiah HaShiloni. And then there's some prophecies from Eliyahu. And then there's some prophecies from Eliyahu's student. So when it says Yirmiyahu wrote the Sefer, he probably wrote the bulk of it and modified the older works to fit into his book that God commanded him to write. That makes him kind of a little bit of an author, but also an editor of previous work. Surely Yirmiyahu did not write the words in Sefer Malachim that King Achaz took rulership in the year 12 and his mother's name was X, Y, and Z. That's obviously something that he had in front of him. He took that information and put it into his own book. So it's a little bit in between editing and authorship, but the text does support that the word lechtov in the Gemara's time can mean editing or authorship, and here, in the case of Kohelet, it seems quite clear that the book wasn't, in any event, whatever it is, if Chizkiyahu finalized the book, whether he was an editor or author, all of a sudden we're only 50 years away from when Persia is heavily involved in the Israeli area. So again, you know, whether Shlomo was not its author, according to the rabbis, not its author, I'm sorry, but not its finalizer of the book, so that's incorrect in Telushkin's book when he writes that that's true. But moreover, even if Shlomo had written every single word, it is not an anachronism that the word pardes shows up. Is it probable? No, it's a little bit out there. You'd have to kind of stretch it a little bit. But it's certainly within the range of possibility that Shlomo knew and understood the word pardes. Anyway, so that's kind of, I went a little bit further into that I wanted to, but I really wanted to dispel the idea of the mistakes that Telushkin has in the book, and because Telushkin's book is wonderful in most cases, and because it's well-read, it's really important that people understand where the errors are. Second of all, he writes something very harsh at the end, Telushkin. He says that the book is very disturbing. It has a wholesale rejection of the afterlife and the belief in reward and punishment. This is, again, not correct. There is no wholesale rejection of afterlife, and I will get to that issue where Kohelet says that the soul of a person, the soul of a parim or behemoth, or animals, all go to the same place. That may be the literal meaning of the book, but I will show over and over again that's not what Shlomo King Solomon meant, nor is it what Chizkiyahu King Chizkiyahu meant, and therefore there is no wholesale rejection of afterlife at all, although I won't get to that till next week. He then writes at the end, I sometimes wonder if by attributing the book to Solomon, the rabbis were exacting a gentle revenge on the ancient Jewish monarch. getting him back from marrying so many wives or whatever Telushkin feels is wrong. It was bad about Solomon. Again, there was no such attribution. And here I want to say something that a friend of mine, Professor Aaron Kohler, who is really a great Bible scholar, said to me. And something that I'll demonstrate not this week, but next week. This week I'll focus on unity. Next week I'll focus on all of these things which seem very depressing in Qohelet. And what Aaron Kohler said to me is, you know what? If there's one book which speaks to modern man who doesn't just write the outcome, he goes through a process. Some days modern man wakes up and just says, where is God and why are all these things, bad things happening? Now, in the book of Eov, there are these questions, but ultimately the answer in Eov is, you just don't know. Because God is the master of the universe, and there's no way that the puny human mind can imagine all of God's plans. So therefore, you have really no right to challenge him. Qohelet is much more modern in that sense. He does challenge God, and he answers it, and he throws a thesis, and then an antithesis, and he gets depressed some days, but other days he feels very strong about it. We'll find some places where there is great hope in Qohelet, which follows great despair in Qohelet. It's this kind of honesty, which is almost modern, and there's no reason that just because King Solomon may have moments of doubt and pain, a modern person understands that you could be an incredibly holy person and still go through doubt and pain. So to really get down on the book makes no sense. To say that it was, you know, attributed to Solomon out of revenge really makes no sense. It is a beautiful book. And in the end, I will demonstrate today, in the next 40 minutes, that Qohelet listened to his depression, his down days, and then overcomes them with great hope and great belief in God. And I'll demonstrate that unity, and hopefully I'll demonstrate the Kedusha of the book, and hopefully that will dispel Telushkin's very unfortunate chapter in his book about Jewish literacy. And now on to the text itself. What I'm going to do is, if you have a Tanakh, it's best to look inside yourself. I will put the information on the screen from time to time just to demonstrate some interesting things, but it will probably help to have a Tanakh in front of you. Qohelet can be found somewhere in the Chamesh Megillot. So if you look for Esther or Ruth in that area, you will find Qohelet there. Depending on your Tanakh, will depend on the order. Usually it may very well be the first book that's in your Chamesh Megillot, because it's the first one we read in the new year, that is on Sukkot, and sometimes they go in yearly order. Now, I'm going to put up a piece of text, and I'll comment on the text as we go along. So if you'll bear with me, you should have that text floating up on your screen in just a second. Show my desktop. Okay, let's hope this comes up okay. Okay, I'm just looking at my other computer to see if it came up on the screen okay. I still see a black screen. Shalom, are you getting a black screen still also? Okay. It's coming up on the screen, and what I would suggest doing, if it helps out, is to click on Fit to Screen at the bottom, and that'll put the whole thing within
a
window.
We're seeing nothing out here in TV land.
Oh, now I'm getting it. Do you now get it? Is it coming on now? Shalom, is it any better? All right, let me try that again. Okay. Shalom, are you seeing that? I'm seeing it on my other computer. David from Brooklyn, do you see that the Kohelet chapter 1 on the screen? Okay, I seem to see. I'm not hearing. Oh, it was best the first time. I'm sorry. I was messing around, and now I have it not so great, so I apologize. I'm just going to read it, though, as is, and if you have a Tanakh, it's probably for the best. I'm going to read the text. Divrei Kohelet ben David melech b'Yerushalayim, and that seems to be Shlomo, but don't forget that all kings who were nearly messianic, such as Josiah, Yoshiahu, and Chizkiyahu, who's attributed with the book, are also called ben David in the text. So when Chizkiyahu is putting together the book, he may be channeling Shlomo, bringing Shlomo's words and using his own. Havel Havalim Amar Kohelet, Havel Havalim HaKol Havel. Now, Havel Havalim, obviously the focus here is the word Hevel. And the question is, what does it mean? So in many English translations, it says vanities. What I would prefer to go with is more of a Tanakh a phrase. Hevel is the hot air that comes off of a fire or comes out of the lungs of a person, which quickly dissipates. What that means generally in Tanakh is Hevel is something which is like a steam that simply disappears. And I'll show how that sense of the word is very important to the understanding. Also, I want to notice, by the way, the word Hevel, not by accident, is used in Bereshit. If you remember, Adam had two sons that didn't get along, to say the least. There was Cain and there was Hevel. Now, Cain received the name for it from his mother, Asher Kaniti Kaniti Ish Et Elohim. Hevel is never named. It never says, and Chava gave her son's name Hevel. Or there's no such thing. In fact, Hevel never has a name. So while Hevel is the good guy in the story, and Cain is the bad guy in the story, Cain is the one who actually leaves descendants and people come out of him. Hevel ultimately disappears. No matter how great he was, the bottom line is he never had kids, and he never amounted to anything. Not because he wasn't a great guy, because sometimes that's what happens. I mean, let me continue on with verse 3. And again, please jot down if you can't hear me, okay, so just let me know, because I can't hear you when I have the presentation up. So the other question that what we have when we read is, what Yitron means, what benefit, what profit does man have with all of the work that he does tachar ha-shamesh, underneath the sun? And generally speaking, the question is, what does it mean underneath the sun? And that I'm going to get back to also, because it actually is a metaphor. That is, in a simple way, you could say anything that happens on the earth. So, and everything that happens on the earth is underneath the sun. But what I'll demonstrate is that actually has a metaphoric meaning, which means something else. But before we do that, let me show you the next page of what I want to go to. Just a second. And I highlighted some words which are going to come out a little fuzzy by you, but notice what happens. Dor holech v'dor ba, v'ha'aretz li'olam omedet. A generation goes, a generation comes and goes, and the world is here forever and ever. The aretz is here forever and ever. So in verse number 4, we have the aretz. In verse 5, we have zarach ha-shemesh, uva ha-shamesh, the sun shines and the sun sets. The El Mekomo Shoev Zoreach Husham, and then it comes back to its point, Shoev, it desires to get back to its starting point, and then it starts all over again. So both Sukkim, notice they're very cyclical. Generations come, generations go. The sun rises, the sun goes. But notice that we have Eretz, the land. We have Shemesh, the sun. In verse number 6, we have Holechel Darom Sovev Al Tzafon. Now Rashi says that this is talking about the sun, but most of the Mefarshim understand, say that this is talking about the ruach, the wind, which is about to be referenced in this verse. So let's read it. Holechel darom sovev al tzafon, sovev sovev alecha ruach vel svivotav shava ruach. Again, it's circular. The wind blows from the north and south and comes back to the north, and it goes round and round and round in a circular fashion, and there's the wind. So we have earth in verse 4. We have fire or sun in verse 5. In verse 6, we have ruach, which is wind, and in verse 7, we have kol hanachalim hochim elayam. All the rivers flow into the ocean. Vayam inenu malei, but the ocean never fills up. El makom shanachalim hochim shamim shavim malechet. Wherever the rivers go, that's where they return. That is back to the ocean. So again, in all four pesukim, we have a circular nature of things. Let me come back to you now, and let me come back to you now just so I could explain something, and then we'll take a look a little bit more at this item. So what's common about these verses, and hopefully I should be able to hear you okay now. What's common about all these verses is, first of all, there's a sense of hopelessness. Everything goes round and round and round and round, and we all know what's going to happen, and therefore a generation comes, a generation goes, and it really just goes round and round, and everything is predictable. But what's also interesting is the use of the four elements. Now that, sometimes, again, it's not anachronistic. It's not that King Solomon couldn't have known about the four elements, but the four elements are more of a Greek thing that we first come about in the 7th century, which might be a little bit anachronistic for Shlomo, but is not anachronistic for Chizkiyahu, and may not be anachronistic for either one. But each one of those four elements is mentioned. First, we have the Aretz in verse 4. In verse 5, we have Shemesh. In verse 6, we have the Ruach. And verse 7, we have the ocean. So we have earth, air, water, earth, fire, wind, and water. Now, what I'd like to do is I'm going to switch now to the last chapter in the book. So I'm going to go to Show My Desktop and switch back into that PowerPoint presentation. And take us to chapter 11. You may want to scroll a little bit so you can see all of chapter 11. You can scroll right at the bottom of the page. Now, what's very important, I should make a short aside in pointing out that the chapters of Kohelet, like all of Tanakh, were done by a Christian archbishop named Stephen Langton. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury in about the 12th century. He also worked on the Magna Carta. And while he was a very great scholar, there's no doubt about it, and he knew the Bible, he makes two mistakes in the very chapter that we're working on. First of all, in the first chapter, he continues the chapter too long. He should cut off the chapter after maybe a few more psukim where we left off, but certainly not the whole first chapter. Here, he only gives you chapter 11 is really quite short, and he cuts it off from chapter 12. But I will show you today that really chapter 11 and chapter 12 are without question the same chapter. So really, we just read, first we looked at the first chapter in the book, which had the four elements, and now if you take a look, we have essentially, we have the same thing, and I've highlighted that item. Shlach lach machal pnei amayim, cast out your bread onto the waters. Ki berov hayamim tinsenu, because you'll find it in the ocean. I'm not going to get into exactly what it means, I just want to show you the four elements. Tein chelik l'shiva v'gam l'shmona, break your things up to 7 and 8, and again, I will get to exactly what that means soon. Ki lo tiyeh ma'yera al ha'aretz, there's the second element, aretz. Now, if you skip to verse Gimel, we have a combination of the water and the ruach. Take a look. Im yimalu ha'avim geshem, if the clouds fill up with water, ala aretz yariku v'im yipol eitz b'darom, and if a tree falls in the south, v'im tzafon, and maybe in the north, makom sheyipol ha'eitz sham yehu, wherever the tree falls, that's where you'll find it. And I'll get to what that means in a second, but let's take a look at the elements in verse 4. Shomer ruach lo yizra, somebody who watches the wind all the time never seeds, v'ro'eh be'avim, and somebody who's always looking for the clouds, lo yiksor. So there we have the ruach, the wind. And then finally in verse 7, take a look at the bottom of the section. It says, u'matoka or v'tov le'inayim, lirot et ha'shamesh. So once again, we have the four elements in the first chapter and the four elements in the last chapter. But if we only had it, you might say it's a coincidence. But now what I'll do is I'll explain to you that those elements are the exact opposite of each other. And let me get there. I'm going to go to one more page and demonstrate what I mean. Here, what you should have in front of you now is a side-by-side. So I highlighted the ocean in gray, the land in green, the ruach in like a dark yellow, and the sun, shemesh, in a light yellow. But if you notice, I'm also going to highlight something else right now for you. Let me see if I could get it nice and highlighted. If you notice, there's something here that says, Holech, in the first chapter, it says, Holech el darom v'sovev al tzafon. I highlighted that. You should see that in verse 6 on the right-hand side. That's the wind that goes round and round forever and ever. But look at the contrast on the other side. In Yipol on verse 3 in chapter 11, it says, Im yipol eitz bedarom, ve'im bitzafon, there it is, the south and the north, makom sheyipol ha'eitz sham yehu, wherever the tree falls, that's where it will be. And here's the incredible, do you see that? If anybody could type in or mention if they see that, where not only are all the elements matched up, but all of a sudden we have the opposite. The wind goes round and round from the north to the south, but the tree, if it falls in the north or in the south, wherever it falls, that's where it will be. I'm going to come out of the screen mode and go back into conference mode now. And here I want to get into this incredibly important point. And I want to say, by the way, I could take 2 minutes to say, all of the Torah that I have in front of you, I learned from Rav Yoel ben Nun, who's one of the great Tanakh scholars and teachers in Israel. And I'm really mostly giving of the Torah that that he taught to me. And he also said something very interesting. He said, when it comes to authorship and when it was written, all that's very interesting. But what's much more interesting is the contents of the book. So that's what we'll focus on. What happens is, in the first chapter, everything is circular. A generation comes, a generation goes. A generation comes, and a generation goes. It's over and over and over and over again, to the point where it really, human beings really have not much hope. Then we have the wind going round and round, and the sun going round and round, and everything goes round and round and round and round, and because we know exactly what's going to happen, and there's never a change, everything is very circular, it causes despair from Kohelet. Because everything is so predictable, and because man's life is so temporary, Kohelet finds no happiness in that. But in chapter 11, or the last chapter, chapter 11 and 12, the exact opposite thing happens. And if you have a Tanakh, you should really, it's probably best to take a look inside, but I'll read the words again. If we take a look at verse 1, what happens is things have changed from circular to linear, and the change was with a tree. That new element that was introduced in verse 3, which was the tree. We also use the word darom and safom, but as opposed to something circular, there was a linear quality. Makom sheyipol ha'eitz, sham yehu. When the tree falls down, it doesn't get back up again and fall down again and get back up again and fall back again. Wherever the tree falls, that's where you could find it, which means you can find stuff. And let me demonstrate, going back to the beginning of the chapter, exactly what is happening here. Because Kohelet is now, at the end of the book, he has tremendous hope, tremendous hope. Shalach lachmecha al pnei amayim, cast your bread on the water, ki berov hayamim timtzeenu. Cast it in the water because you know what? You may find it one day. That is, take a chance. Because even though the oceans are great, you may find it even though the oceans are great. And then here's a beautiful pasuk, which is just, it's a little difficult to understand, but when I explain it, I think it'll really become clear. Tein chelek l'shiva v'gam l'shmona. Separate, give your things into seven and also into eight. Ki lo teida ma yiyeh ra'al ha'aretz. Because you don't know where the bad things will come on the earth. Now, somebody reading that might think, oh, he's being very negative. Bad things will happen. But it's the exact opposite. What tein chelek l'shiva v'gam l'shmona means is diversify. Don't just put all your money into bonds, or don't put all your money into Merrill Lynch, or don't put all your money into any, or into the Lehman Brothers, or all your money into real estate, because you never know what might go bad. Take all of your capabilities, all of your wealth, all of your assets, be them financial or otherwise, and diversify. And by diversifying, if one thing goes bad, you'll have other opportunities. It's just a beautiful pasuk. He also says, continue on verse 3, Imi maluhe avim geshem al aretz yariku, v'imi pol eitz b'darom v'imi tzafon. So when he gets to the water and the wind, by combining the water and the wind, he gives us the process of rain, which means, yeah, sometimes it simply rains on the ground. So if things are working out really well, and as opposed to chapter 1 where he says the oceans fill up with the water and fill and never cease their filling, there are other things that gather water, such as clouds, and those clouds may in fact bring you the rain that you need. continuing on in this sense, to verse in this agricultural sense in verse 4, Shomer Ruach Lo Yizra V'ro'eb Avim Lo Yiktzor. So he's giving you mussar. He's giving you advice. He's saying, listen, you spend all your time looking at the wind go round and round and round and looking at the clouds float by and by. Either you wonder what, so if you're always worried about the fact that the wind's going to come back, you'll never plant your seeds. You'll never seed your fields because you're afraid the seeds will blow away. And if you're always worried about when the clouds may rain, you're never going to gather up your lo yiktzor. You won't gather up your stuff. What he's saying is don't do it. Take a chance. Because yes, it might rain, but then again, it might not rain. And yes, the wind might blow, but then again, it may not blow before your seeds get a chance to shoot their roots. And then the next pasuk, he just puts it straightforward. Kasher incha yodea maderecha ruach, ka'atzamim bevetin hamlea. Just like you don't know when the wind's going to blow, just like you can't see, and here's something very interesting. Ka'atzamim bevetin hamlea means like the bones or the fetus, which is inside the full belly, the pregnant uterus. So you have no idea what God's going to do. So it is a little, this is a little bit not anachronistic, but it doesn't completely apply to today's day and age. And the reason why it doesn't completely apply is because now we have sonograms, so we could actually see what's going on inside the mother's womb. But you have to understand that from Shlomo's perspective, from Chizkiyahu's perspective, they could not see what was going on. And you know what? There is a fear. I don't mean to get too personal here, and maybe it's not really appropriate for this forum, but I hope you'll forgive me. But Baruch Hashem, I have four children, and Baruch Hashem, they're healthy. But I don't know how you felt or whether you went through this process, but every time we went through this process, my wife and I, there's a fear. There's a fear that something may go wrong. There's something that something may wrong be with the child. There's a fear that my wife might become sick. I mean, it happens. And yet you do what you have to do because kasherin chayodeya, you don't know how God works. And just like you don't know how God works, you don't know how the pregnancy will turn out. And you don't know how whether the winds will come. So in chapter 1, because everything was cyclical, you knew everything. And by knowing everything, that sureness led to despair. Oh, I know it's going to rain on me. I know everything's going to float away. But in chapter 11, the last chapter, it's man's very limitations. Things are not so circular, first of all. Sometimes things just happen, and wherever they fall, that's where they fall. But the very uncertainty of the future gives Kohelet hope. In the beginning, Kohelet was certain about everything. He knows everything, and because he knows everything, he has despair. By chapter 11, what he's figured out is he does not know everything. There are things which are out of his hands. Some things in nature are out of his hands. The acts of God are out of his hands. And because you don't know, that gives you hope. And now let's take a look at the beautiful verse 6. Baboker zarat zarecha. So in the morning, go out and seed your seeds in the fields. Vila erev al tanach yadecha. But when you come home at night, don't put your hand down. Ki encha yodea, because you don't know. Do you see that over and over again? Encha yodea in verse 5. Encha yodea in verse 6. You don't know which one will work. The morning work or the evening work, or maybe they'll both work out. But at least you have a 75% chance. Now Chazal understand, what does it mean not to rest your hand at night? It means to have babies, to have children, to come back and sow your seeds in the procreative sense, in the sense of having children. So you don't know, maybe you'll have a beautiful family, or maybe you won't. Or maybe you'll become rich by, planting your seeds and you'll have a great farm and you'll be able to support people with your riches. You don't know what will work. So do both. Diversify. And because you don't know which one will work, there's at least a chance that one of them will work, a 75% chance that either one or both will work. And it's that very doubt. Take a chance. Get dirty, so to speak. And that very fact that you don't know gives Kohelet hope at the end of the book. And to read it again. Al tanach yadecha ki incha yodea eze yichshar hazeh ozev im shneim kechad tovim. And that's a very important concept. So what I've shown you is that there's very much unity between the first chapter and the last chapter. But now you might be asking me, you might be saying, fine, but what is Kohelet, crazy? How does he really feel? How does Shlomo HaMelech really feel? Is he believe everything is cyclical and you know everything? Or does he believe that you don't know everything and therefore you should take a chance and there is room for hope? And the answer is both. It's a process. And this is what we'll see, especially next week. Kohelet is being honest with himself, like Professor Kohler said. He's expressing his doubts. But he's not just expressing his doubts and closing the book and walking away. He expresses his doubts, in my opinion, and then later, as he goes through a process, he comes to a different conclusion. Now, you could say that's cyclical. I mean, some days I wake up and I feel great, other days I feel bad, and then another day I feel good. As long as I keep an open mind, I may come back to feeling good. So it could be Kohelet simply waffles back and forth, but I would say that it's much stronger than that. Kohelet starts like we all do, just being a little depressed that we're such small entities in this world, and that everything is predictable, and we're going to go back to chapter 1 in a second and show you what else he's upset about. But by the end of the book, having worked through all of his problems, some of which we'll take a look at next week, he himself grows, he matures, he comes to a greater, more believing philosophy. And what's very interesting is one of the changes between the first chapter of Kohelet and the last chapter of Kohelet is the first chapter of Kohelet, with all of these circular things, God's name is not mentioned once. Not once. The world goes round and round and round, and everything goes round and round, and nothing you do is worth anything. But God is not mentioned. But if you look at chapter 11, take a look at chapter 11, verse 6 again. Verse 5. Kasher incha yodea, because you do not know maderecha ruach, which way the wind will blow. Just like ta'atzamim bebetan amleah, just like you don't know what a fetus is like inside the mother's womb, at least back then you didn't. Kacha lo teda maseh Elohim, so you don't know what God is up to. He does things that we cannot predict. Asher yaseh et hakolim, because he has his hands in everything, or he creates everything. And you cannot follow God, you cannot completely understand God. That gives you the hope that what you do will in fact succeed rather than fail. Now I'd like to go back to chapter 1, and I would suggest, if you can, go back to chapter 1. And I'd like to get back to that issue of what I demonstrated in chapter 1 and in chapter 12 is these four elements. By going back to chapter 1, I'd like to show you four other things. And I'm going to switch to full screen mode just so you can see it. So if you'll be patient with me, I'll just show you chapter 1 on the screen and highlight certain things. Let's see if I have this PowerPoint. I think it's in my PowerPoint. I'll give it a try. If not, there's another way to do this. Ah, no, that's chapter 11. That's not what I want. Sorry, just a second. I'll try that again. Okay, what you should have in front of you shortly is Kohelet chapter 1. Let me just take a look and see if it's coming in okay. Okay, does everybody see that? Is that coming in okay? Now, let's continue on. What I'd like to show you is four other things. Kohelet here, Shlomo HaMelech, let's just call him Kohelet, asserts four things in chapter 1. And as I said, if you notice, I'm going to scroll down and show you chapter 1 continues with verse 12. But this is a mistake on our friend Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton's part. If you notice, the Torah itself, Tanakh itself, separates chapter 11 and 12 with a ptucha, a open break. And that means really chapter 1 absolutely ends right there after 11 verses. So, Kohelet makes four assertions. Havel havalim amar Kohelet, havel havalim akol havel. Everything, it's an assertion. Everything is transient. Everything is vanity. Everything that you do is going to disappear for reasons of the cyclical nature, because eventually your generation will come, but then your generations will go. The second assertion that he makes is in verse 3. Ma yitron la'adam b'chol amaloshi amol tachar ha'shemesh. And even if you want to say that's true, in 100 years nobody will remember that great factory or those great Air Nike shoes that you developed, at least you're working hard right now. Well, he makes an assertion and says, all the money that you're going to make, all the yitron, all the profits, they're not worth anything because it's all going to disappear. And I'll show you that Takara Shemesh is a metaphor for one day you're going to die, and as they say, you can't take it with you. After the four elements, he says something very interesting. He says, number four assertion, Masha Aya Hu Sheyeh, whatever was, it will be. Masha Nasar Hu Sheyeh, saying what was already done will always be done. The Ein Kol Chadash Takara Shemesh, which means even if you wanted to think that you're inventing a brand new widget that nobody else has ever thought about, you're wrong. Yesh Davar Sheyomar Re'ezeh Chadashu. Some people might say, look, this is a new thing. Wrong. The end of chapter, verse 9, Kvar Hayah Lo'olamim Asher Hayah Lefaneihu. Believe me, if you come up with an idea, somebody else has come up with it first. And finally, the fourth assertion, Ein Zichron La'achronim V'larishonim, Zichron La'arishonim, the first generations are not remembered. V'gam La'achronim Sheyu Lo Yeh Lahem Zichronim Im Sheyu Achronan. People that are born afterwards, they are forgotten and every generation is forgotten. These are four assertions. One is everything is transient. Number two is there's no profit of what you do. Number three is whatever you do is not new anyway. And number four is even if you do something nice, nobody's going to remember it. Because not only are you going to die, but nobody's going to remember that Rabbi Levi gave a shiur on whatever. Now this is, as I mentioned, chapter one is his area of distress. It's his area of nothing is useful, I know exactly what's going to happen, all of life is circular, nothing amounts to something. And these are four assertions that he makes. But now let me take you to chapter 11-12, which we'll have to look at slowly. In none of a chapter 11 do any of these assertions come back. Even though he repeats the elements by contrasting against them, by showing them that there is hope because you don't know what might happen, and you can't predict everything, then all of these assertions disappear, as four assertions disappear. The only assertion that remains is at the end of this chapter. And let's skip over to chapter 12. And if you notice, chapter 12 also has a break right at verse V'yoter Shayah Kohel HaChacham. This is really an addendum to the book. You can see he's talking about himself. V'yoter Shayah Kohel HaChacham, more Kohel it was wise. Perhaps it's easy here to say that this might be Chizkiyahu speaking. So really the end of the conceptual part of the book ends in the pasuk before. So he mentions, look at the elements that come up. The afar goes back to the earth. There's the earth. The ruach tashuv and the wind and the spirit goes back to God who gave it to you. So he brings back these elements. And before that we have the word mabua, which is the water. But he ends off with the following assertion. Does everybody see that assertion that I highlighted? That is, in the beginning, there was nothing you could do was new. There's no benefit, there's no profit, nobody remember a thing that you do. In the end, he doesn't repeat those assertions at all. He believes that there is a profit in what you could do, and he explains in the middle of the book. He believes that sometimes you do come up with a wonderful, brand new idea. He believes that sometimes people will remember you, and that's, you know, an example of that is Rashi. Is Rashi not alive today? People read his book every day. Now, we're not all as fortunate as Rashi. But some way, somehow, your name may in fact be remembered, or something wonderful that you did, even if they don't quote that it's from you, you may have introduced something that has a benefit to the world, that lasts for generation to generation. But there is one assertion that Kohelet cannot get away from. Havel Havalim Amar Kohelet Hakol Havel. Ultimately, the human life, your human life, ends. That doesn't mean there's no Olam Haba. That doesn't mean there's reward and punishment. It's just you get one chance in this world. Let's avoid the idea of resurrection, reincarnation. We can't deal with those issues. God deals with issues of reincarnation, of resurrection, reincarnation. I'm not entirely sure where it fits into the Jewish thought, but that's for God to worry about. Like, I can't leave my life knowing, oh, I'll get a second chance, because you may not. God gives us one chance in this world to deserve anything. And unfortunately, there's a time limit. We are Havel Havalim, the wind comes out of our breath, the breath comes out of our mouth, eventually the breath stops coming out of our mouth, the ruach, the spirit, that wind, that animating force goes back to God, and that was our one chance in this world. It's not Kohelet denying the next world. Kohelet is simply saying something that we all understand. I mean, if it was all about getting to the next world, then I guess suicide would be okay. Why should I be in this world? I want to get to the next world as fast as possible. But that goes against basic Jewish thought. Other religions may believe in that, but Judaism never believes in that. Judaism believes you got to make 1,000%. You have to take advantage of every single second. Like David says, Yisor Yisrani Yahu L'mavet Lo Tanat Natanani. You can punish me, God, as much as you want. Just don't let me die. Because every second the world is valuable, because there's one more chance to do another great thing. And ultimately, Kohelet is telling you something that telling us all something that we can't get away with. In the end, we may be great. We may come up with something new. We may pass on our name to the next generation. But the truth is, you got to work hard. You got to really work at it, because ultimately, you only get one chance in this life before the wind goes back, and then you yourself are Havel Havalim. And if you didn't accomplish anything, then ultimately it all goes back to God. What I'd like to show now, I'd like to go, we have about 3 more minutes. Are there any questions? I don't want to complete, I'm going to go back to video mode. Just a second. Does anybody have any questions? I'm going to go back to video mode so I could hear questions. That's a funny item, Gary, who was really late. You're always welcome, Gary. Are there any challenges on what I've said or things that aren't clear, this development of thought process that goes on from despair and being to hope at the end to circular, where God is not involved, to more linear, where God is involved and therefore, you take chances, and where Kohelet really has great faith in the end of human ability to succeed, but he cannot help himself but end off with the truth, which is eventually we're all going to die. Now, that being said, I want to show something very important. If you remember, there was one item I didn't translate at the beginning, which is all the work that you do has no value, has no profit, all the work that you work under the sun. Now, what I could show you is that those words under the sun are a metaphor, and that metaphor comes up in chapter 11 and 12. So let's go back to chapter 11 and 12, and it's very important to demonstrate that just like Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, and just like Mishlei, which is named metaphors, is metaphors, you have to be very careful when you're reading the text, because sometimes you could read X and it really means Y. Sometimes I think I could be reading about women, and Kohelet and Shlomo is talking about wisdom, which he does in the first book of Mishlei. In fact, he calls his woman the personification of wisdom. So here, too, there's a mashal, there's a metaphor going on in Shlomo, because that's what he was really good at. And what I'm going to go on, just in case, I'm afraid that you may not have a Tanakh, so I'm going to go over to full screen. If that's okay with anybody, I'll just wait a few seconds. If anyone says, don't go to full screen, I won't go. But otherwise, I'm going to go to full screen and give you the last chapter of Kohelet. Okay, I'm going to show my desktop and bring up the last chapter, which is really the two chapters 11 and 12. Okay, that should be coming up soon, and chapter 11, and I'll scroll to the bottom. And I am on verse 7 now, Zion. And this is after he says, he comes to the conclusion, take your chances because you don't know what might work. And just because one of them will fail, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try it. And now let's get to the next part. It is so sweet, the light, and it is so good for the eyes to see the sun. And now you know exactly what he's talking about. The sun is the time that we have on this earth, the ability to see the light. And how do I know that? Because he reinforces that in the next verse. Even if a person lives a long time, the chulam yismach, and he should really be happy about them. And if he is happy about them, but let him remember the days of darkness, because they will be a long, long time, and everything that comes with it evaporates. What that means is shemesh, an ore, is a metaphor for the days that we get on this earth, sweet life, matoka or, and the choshech are the days that come after that, your days of death. And he's saying you should really remember that those are coming because they could last a long, long time. Now you could say, well, Mashiach could come two days after I die and I'll come right back to life. But for most of us, we spend what I like to call in heaven is sort of a bullpen or a waiting stage until Mashiach comes. We have our life, we prove whether we're worth it or not in this world, and then we hang out with God, which may be very nice, but it's still just a waiting place for Mashiach to come. And those days are darkness because life is sweet. Life is sweet. And while we're in heaven, and I'm sure there's a beautiful nature about the heaven and being able to be close to God, there's no possibility for perfecting oneself in heaven. You can't give charity and love in that sense. Everything you are in heaven, you accomplished in this world. And in that sense, it's darkness. Not because it's not beautiful, because it's not what we're all about. We're all about doing wonderful things and making the world better. So he goes on to say, "Smach b'chur b'yal d'techa v'tivchal ibechem b'chur techa v'alech b'darchei libcha mei anayin v'dak kol eile yibiyachalohim v'mishpat." Everything that you do in this world, don't forget that God will bring you to justice. You must pay the price for everything that you do. V'aser kas b'libecha, so take the sadness and the anger from their heart. V'aver rami b'sarecha ki ayaldut v'asacharu t'havel. Because youth is quickly gone. So forget about all the vast emotions one has as a young person, because remember, they disappear. And now I'd like to just go quickly and show you this metaphor in chapter 12. Zechor et borecha v'yimei b'churotecha ad asher lo yavo yimei hara'a, that's death, v'yigiyu shanim asher tamar ein li bahem chepetz, I have no desire from them. That word chepetz is important. We'll see that next week. Because Hashem says, La'eit kol chefetz. And now we seem to have a metaphor. Ad asher lo techshach ha-shemesh, the sun will go out. And again, I demonstrate that means that's your life going out. Va'or ve'areach kochavim, and any of that light. V'shavu ha'avim afar ha-geshem, and all the clouds disappear after the rain. V'yom she'azu shomrei ha-bayit, in the day when the guardians of the house start to shake. And that is a metaphor, and that means the arms of a human being. The hands and the arms, those are the Shomrei Abayit, and they start to get weak and to shake. V'hit avtu anshei achayil, and the soldiers, the men soldiers, start to bend. And that's the legs that bend in the old age. U'batlu atochanoki mietu, and the grinders start to get canceled out, no longer work because there's so few left. And that's the teeth that start to fall from the mouth in old age. V'chashchu ara'ot barubot, and the guardians, the watchers in their towers, can no longer see, and that's the eyes that start to go dim. The suguru dlatayim bashuk, and the doors open up in the marketplace, which means the lips start to fall backwards. Bishval kol atachana, as the teeth, the grinders start to disappear. You'll see that if a person takes out their dentures and their teeth, their lips cave in. The akum kol atzipur, v'yishakol kol benot ashir, and the voice starts to disappear. The gami gavoi yirao, and now we're out of the metaphor. And an old person, what are they afraid of? Chatchatim baderech, you can't even walk across a crack without being scared because you might fall. Vayneitza shakatev yisabela chagav, tafer of yonah. These are apparently things that have short life cycles. Kiolecha adam obeito lamo v'sovavoga shuka sofim, because eventually people die. Ad asher lo yirateh chevel hakesef. Chevel hakesef is the spine. The tarutz gulata zahav, the golden ball is the skull. And it all falls down into the pit, which is, of course, the grave. So while there is great hope that a human being can do great things, Kohelet is saying you get one chance. And when it's over, forget about Olam Haba. This is the place that you get your chance to be great. And because it all disappears very fast, and once it disappears, you don't get a second chance on this planet if you did not do a great job. Make sure that in your youth, when you have your arms and you have your legs and you have your teeth and you have your voice, that remember that to use them in the correct way. And then, in the end, it won't be so choshech. It will be choshech. But it will be choshech that God willing, in the times of Mashiach, will come back for or. And then because of what we did in the world the first time, because we understood that at Kol Havel, the world will become a perfect place when we come back in the times of Mashiach. And that's pretty much the shiur. And next week we'll get into the issue of how King Shlomo goes back and forth and how he makes this discovery, how he goes from despair in chapter 1 to recognition of God and hope, even though you're going to die, but real hope in the final chapter. And that is essentially That is essentially the shear. It's already 10 o'clock, but I guess if there are any last-minute questions, I'd be happy to answer them. No questions? You're very, very welcome. Gary, that's a very good question. Let me take a look at that pasuk for a second. I never thought about it. I don't immediately see a thematic connection between the two, Yitron and Yoter. It could be a poetic connection, that is, in order for Shlomo to demonstrate that he's writing the whole book, or in this case, Chizkiyahu, to show that he's, you know, connecting the whole book, so he wants to use a word at the beginning that he uses at the end. So it may be just a literary device called an envelope to make sure that you understand that the book is a unity. And anybody, what I've really tried to demonstrate is anybody who says this book is not a unity really is not reading correctly. However, it is possible that Ein Yitron, there is no prophet, but Yoter Mizeh, think about this for what the real prophet in the world is to fear God and to do his mitzvot, and from that is the best prophet. So it could be that Yoter, to really pay attention to God and mitzvot, contrasts the Yitron, the financial prophet, which sort of gets Kohelet down in the beginning. So it could be there is a thematic connection. I have to give it more thought. I have to give it more thought. Okay, very good. Signing off, and I hope to see you next week. Have a wonderful, wonderful day. Wonderful night.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.